This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh, and today we are glad to have Patrick Hastings with us. He's the creator of this famous website, Ulysses Guide, and he's the English department chair at Gilman School in Baltimore, Maryland. Today he's here to talk to us about his recently published book, The Guide to James Joyce Ulysses, published by Johns Hopkins University. Patrick, welcome to New Books Network.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation.
We want to ask you everything we always wanted to know about James Joyce, but we were afraid to ask.
And I'll do my best.
Yeah, James Joyce, he's this infamously difficult writer to approach, but you've been brave enough to read him many, many times. I guess you'll tell us how many times you have read Ulysses, and also you've created this great website, Ulysses Guide. So tell us a little about yourself. What attracted you to James Joyce novels, and what made you design that website and then write this book?
Yeah, so I you know, in thinking about this project, there's something kind of preposterous about trying to write a guide to James Joyce's Ulysses, because there's so much in it and there's so many different angles that you can take, and so much to know and so much to not know about this novel. So there's something absurd about this project in and of itself, but I've had a lot of fun working on it. And the actual project of the website that then became the book emerged first and foremost from a desire to provide a resource to my own students at Gilman School to help them. I teach a senior elective. So for 18-year-old students, a course for them to read Ulysses. And I wanted to kind of pitch the website to be a resource that they could access at home while they're doing the reading, to help clear up some of those questions that readers encounter of, you know, what's actually happening here, and ground them in the text. And so that when they came to class, I was no longer having to kind of give that sort of orientation in the story of the novel or the plot, where it allowed us to kind of jump forward and be able to talk more about the style of the text, or look more closely at specific passages and how a character is thinking about something, or what allusions are being made, and kind of really break down those without having to look at it more globally. So it was kind of like the initial idea was to to jumpstart each class meeting that I would have with my students by providing them with this to the website to access from home. And I guess it seems like that audience of my Gilman students, who are very bright and very hardworking and really engaged and interested, that the kind of pace or rhythm or level of depth and detail that I went into on the website for them ended up being something that was useful to lots of people. And so I was, you know, pretty amazed, honestly, to find that people all across the world were accessing the website. The first time I kind of became aware of that, it blew me away, and made me take the project more seriously, and really kind of said, okay, well, people are using this, so I need to really kind of be aware of it. But it really was a fun side project that I had going as I was, you know, in the summertime, really, when I could get babysitters for my kids, grab a couple hours to go write, and it was an enjoyment and a bit of fun. And I hope that that comes across in a lot of the writing, is I had a lot of fun working on it. The website then became the book, and we can talk more about that change in a little bit. But yeah, it really emerged just from a desire to support my students, just like most English teachers do. You know, they want their students to appreciate and enjoy the literature that they're teaching.
Well, I wish I had a teacher like you when I was when I first started reading Joyce. You know, we were just given this novel, and it was extremely difficult, especially I read that book when I was still learning English as a second language, and it made it way, way more challenging, because you don't really know if it's real word or if it's just making it up.
Yeah, well, reading Ulysses is like reading a second language too. I mean, so you're kind of learning a third language as you're learning a second one. I'm pretty consistently amazed by how many people around the world, from Sweden, from Portugal, from Italy, from Iran, have accessed the website and are interested in, you know, learning more about this novel, where, you know, the command of English that I feel like I need to have to read the novel, I can't imagine doing so as a you know, learning English as a second language. So how did you go about doing that? Were you reading with other resources? How did you kind of discern what was Joyce's creativity with language and what was English that you could?
So yeah, like I said, I was an undergrad student, and the novel came up. We had a course which was called Novel. That was the name of the course. And there were two courses, actually. Novel, one of them was on British novels, and the other one was on American novels. But anyway, this was as a part of the British novels, even though it was written by Irish writer, but anyway. And we were not asked to read the whole novel, because it was huge and there were some other readings. But when it came to this one, and the teacher warned us that it's a difficult novel, and the only source that I had then, and that was about like 18 years ago. So the only source that I had back then was a website, which was called Monkey Notes, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. Huh. Monkey Notes, yeah. That's a very Spark Notes, sorry. Spark Notes.
Spark Notes, yep.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
There was another one, Monkey Notes, but it wasn't it wasn't as good as a Spark Notes. Spark Notes, which only had, you know, a very, very brief summary of a chapter and the context and a very brief discussion of allusions and symbols. So it didn't really help that much. And the reason is that the story is quite simple in general, because it's a story of one guy, you know, walking around the streets for a day. But that's when you're reading it with English as your second language, and we were still undergrad students in English. So we were reading Shakespeare, we were reading different sonnets, we were reading Greek mythology. So there are lots and lots to pick up, and you don't really pick up all those allusions and references in James Joyce. So it was very difficult. A lot of us were trying to go through the whole novel, but I guess most of us just dropped it. And it wasn't a very nice experience at first, because you need to have somebody, you know, you either need to have a reading group or somebody to guide you, and somebody, of course, to encourage you. Because I know a lot of people who didn't really have to read the novel. They picked up the novel, but they knew it was difficult, but they just dropped it after, you know, going through a few chapters. And that's what we'll talk about as well, right? Some advice for for first-time readers. But now I'm reading it, not because I have to, but I'm really enjoying it, and I'm picking up all those nuances that were put into this by Joyce. Yeah. And you mentioned that this first it was a website, and now you recently published it with Johns Hopkins University. So it's a university publisher. So how difficult or how challenging was it to turn the content of the website into a book that is going to be published by that was to be published by Johns Hopkins University?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it was difficult in part because I in revising the content that I'd written for being published by a university press, in general, which has to go through peer review and receive kind of, you know, thumbs up from other scholars, like that, going through that process, much less going through it with Johns Hopkins University Press, which is, you know, like a pretty, you know, a pretty big deal. I wanted to keep my primary audience in mind, which again was kind of my Gilman students, and then evolved into, you know, began with my Gilman students and then evolved into kind of an awareness of that there were thousands of people every month across the world who were using this, who are, you know, would send me notes and ask me questions, and I engaged in some correspondence. So I had a sense of who was using the website, but also thinking about beefing up more of the scholarly aspects of the writing and presenting more of a survey of critical opinions and critical insight, you know, trying to bring together a lot of the essays and book chapters that I've read pertaining to the Proteus episode or the Lestragonians episode, you know, trying to pull a lot more of that together so that it could be more relevant in a university sort of setting, and more useful to a university setting, and be something that professors might find interesting and useful for their courses, while also not doing so much of the scholarly work that it turned off the first-time readers who were finding the website to be helpful. So it was a little bit of a tricky revision of kind of threading that needle of doing enough to make it a university press publication, but to maintain kind of the voice and pace and accessibility that I had kind of found. It was a challenge of trying to strike that balance, which was really fun. And honestly, I think that when I kind of found a process of pre-writing and like kind of research and kind of preparation before writing the episode guides when I was working on the Oxen of the Sun episode, which is pretty notoriously difficult. So like Oxen, Circe, really the rest of the novel, those last four or five episode guides that I wrote, I'd kind of found a different process of pre-writing and preparation that then when I revised, I am kind of practiced that process going back to Telemachus and revising each of those other episode guides up to that point, kind of rewriting, revising based on that process. So I think eventually I found what was the right balance to strike, and it was just a matter of making the whole, each of the episode guides kind of consistent and coherent in terms of their depth and kind of scholarly rigor. I loved that revision process. There were a couple jokes that I took out, you know, things that were on the website that I thought were funny, but might not stand the test of time, you know, over 30 years. But I will say that when I read the book, I'll get to a certain point and be like, I think I had something that I, you know, funny here, and it's gone. And so I missed those jokes, but I also recognize that, you know, Johns Hopkins University Press isn't looking for a comedy routine. And I'm probably not funny enough to be the guy to do that. So, so it was a little bit of kind of buttoning up a little bit, cause it's a more, it's a more adult sort of project, but keeping the same kind of spirit as I had with the website. Yeah.
You actually mentioned a good point as we were talking. You, in the sense that you wanted to still keep a general audience engagement writing the book. There are a lot of scholarly editions, a lot of edition books with lots and lots of annotations. We have Gift Workbooks, New Bloomsday book, and we have your book as well. I personally have gone through most of them, and I found this one, your book, very helpful. Like I said, I first started with your website, and now I got the book as well. Very useful to start reading a novel. So can you tell us how your book is different from, for example, Gift Workbooks or New Bloomsday book?
Sure. Well, and to be clear, Gifford's book and the Blumirez New Bloomsday book are still great resources that I refer to often and that I used as references throughout my composition. So, you know, this is certainly, and there are other great guidebooks that are out as well. Terrence Killeen has a great guidebook. Ambassador Dan Mulhall has a new book out as well. You know, so I feel like there are lots of people who have approached this novel. And we're all, I hope, and I assume, kind of inspired by the same interest to share this novel that we love and to try to bring Ulysses to as many people as we possibly can and to find its value. So my book is different, I think, from the Gifford book gives all these annotations and it gives explanations for each line, basically, because there's something almost in every line of the novel that's worth exploring and unpacking and explaining either in the context of Dublin in 1904, like what was this street and what shop is he looking at when he's noticing this clothing on display, or a reference to Aristotle or a reference to Shakespeare or a reference to a popular dance hall song in 1904, right? So it's all over the place. And, you know, just like, so the Gifford gives an expert analysis and explanation of each of those references. And there is a new book of annotations by Sam Sloat that's just come out. And actually, I just got it this weekend. It finally landed from Oxford University Press. And it's a big old honking book. And I'm excited to read Ulysses again this fall with that as my kind of resource that I'll use to kind of have, some new ideas and to see what that book reveals as differentiated from the Gifford. And the new Bloomsday book, I think, was kind of more of a like for like comparison to my project. His, I think, gives a little bit more of a straight paraphrase almost or translation go back to kind of the idea of English as a second language and Ulysses as a third language. The new Bloomsday book gives, you know, kind of a straight, like, here's what is happening, plot summary, translation of what's happening in the novel. And I guess I really like that. I found, and I do some of that certainly in my book as well. I find that, I guess what I wanted to do was provide a little bit more commentary, and a little bit more of an integration or incorporation of other scholarly voices and other scholarly opinions into that paraphrase and summary. So my book provides a little bit more, kind of hooks for readers to maybe latch on to as they're reading and say, oh, that makes sense to me. Or, okay, I understand what that scholar is saying, but I disagree with it for X, Y, and Z reasons. And to kind of give people a little bit more of a critical idea of how to read the book, because that's such a big part of what has become the experience of Ulysses for so many readers, is it's not just the text itself, which is endlessly interesting, but it's the way that at this point, 100 years of scholarship have approached that text. And that was something that I wanted to try to expand upon and provide a little bit in a different way. So in the book, at the end of each episode guide, I provide a list of essays or book chapters for further reading that specifically engage ideas from that episode. where people who are interested in some of those ideas and approaching, you know, from a post-colonial or from a queer studies or from a, you know, whatever sort of scholarly critical angle they want to take, they, you know, that they can kind of pursue that. And I've tried to provide those resources to my readers. I found a little bit of a different pace, I think, than maybe the Blumirez or the new Bloomsday book had, of getting through and a depth. And I tried to strike a consistent pace as well that, you know, I love the new Bloomsday book, but there are some moments that I feel like he goes really deep into, but then there are others where I feel like I would like to have a little bit more orientation. So I tried to be a little bit more consistent and not duck some of those sections that are really difficult. I would go to the new Bloomsday book as a reference saying like, well, this is tricky. What's going on here? And there's nothing in the new Bloomsday book. Well, he thought it was tricky too. Well, then I need to make sure that I really read this again and again and again until I have something to offer to my readers about that. Yeah.
Let us talk a little bit about the book itself, Ulysses.
Yep.
What was your first reading experience like, and when was it? And I'm sure you have read it many, many times, right? To be able to write such a great book and create that website.
I've probably read it probably pushing 20 times at this point. Just over and over and over again. It makes me feel a little bit like, you know, maybe expand your interests, but I read other novels and I love other works of literature. But nothing else that I've encountered, or very few other texts have been as rewarding as Ulysses. So I kind of find myself going back to it. On a number of levels, I don't, it's so funny. It's so difficult. It's so, endlessly, providing of that, thrill of discovery. Every time I open the book, I encounter something where I'm like, oh, huh, I never quite noticed that little line there, or who is that? What's that voice? Where's that coming from? That seems different. What's that reference? There's always something that I'm discovering anew. And that's really exciting, I think, for any reader. It can be daunting, of course, right? The first time reader is overwhelmed maybe by how much there is to discover. But the 20th time reader is enriched by that and stimulated by that, because there aren't very many other works of literature or works of art that continue to reward the reader or the person who's experiencing the art, you know, by providing something new. But Ulysses certainly does that. So my first time reading it, it was the fall of my senior year of college. I was at Washington and Lee University in the mountains of Virginia. And my honors thesis was about the literary history of Shakespeare and Company Bookstore, which was a project that had emerged from my time living and working at Shakespeare and Company in the summer of 2003. And I had done some research in the archives and, you know, certainly at Shakespeare and Company, Joyce is part of the story, is part of the kind of spirit of that place. And, the Sylvia Beach Shakespeare and Company, publication of the first edition Ulysses is certainly a part of the lore and legend of that bookshop. So when I came home from Paris, I started writing about kind of the three different generations of writers who had been a part of Shakespeare and Company. So the Lost Generation, the Beat Generation, and the New Generation, which was how Sylvia Whitman, who now is the owner and she runs the shop of books of Shakespeare and Company. She's the bookseller. She organized a literary festival when I was there about Lost, Beat, and New, and that was basically how I organized my honors thesis. As part of that, obviously, if you're going to write about the publication of Ulysses, you probably should read Ulysses. So I had a thesis advisor who I was meeting on Sunday evenings, like every 2 weeks. And he would say, okay, read these three episodes of Ulysses, or read these four episodes, or read these two episodes, whatever he would kind of assign me over the course of that semester. And I was kind of reading on my own. I wasn't going to a class. I wasn't hearing lectures. I was reading on my own with the Gifford, with the New Bloomsday book, similar to lots of readers. Then would meet with him and talk with him for about an hour about what I, you know, kind of what questions I had and where I was confused and what I'd enjoyed and what I'd picked up on. So I guess my first time reading the novel was a little bit unique in that it was outside of a formal classroom setting. But it did allow me, I think, in some ways to, from the very beginning, have an experience with the novel that was my own, and that you know, I was finding enjoyment, and I loved it from the get-go. I loved it. I loved the reading and felt so amazed by how vivid the descriptions are and how, you know, clearly defined these characters are and how much they felt like real people to me. What I felt was the accuracy of the inner monologue technique and how that brought awareness to my own thinking. And as I'd be walking around campus or walking around town, you know, so that experience, of the novel, I was hook, line, and sinker. I was sold right from the beginning and, was doing a lot of the reading on my own. Yeah, late at night at Waffle House in Lexington, Virginia, and had a great time with it. You know, so it was from the very beginning, it was a project that I was finding a lot of fun in, and appreciating its difficulty and but also just having a good time reading this great novel. And that's it was a great first time reading experience.
And I don't think back then there were so many guides to help you read the novel, so it was pretty much you discovering the joy of uncoding all those puzzles and enigmas that Joyce put into the novel.
Yeah. Or being aware of like, okay, I don't understand what this is. Keep going. You know, like I look at that first copy that I read and I was underlining a lot. And I was writing some notes here and there, but for the most part, like I didn't get probably more than 5% of what was going on in the book, but getting 5% of what's going on in Ulysses is pretty good. You know, I think that's, and I kept going, you know, I think that's maybe, in terms of like advice to first time readers, I would say, just keep going. Like there's going to be stuff you don't get. Okay. Yeah. But keep reading. Cause that's life too. There's a lot of stuff that if you're really genuinely curious, as you go through a day, you're going to find a lot of stuff that you don't get. So, but you got to keep going, you know, and maybe circle back and try to, you know, explore that curiosity later, but allow yourself to keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you said that, when you read the book, you were amazed by the accuracy of description and about, it was about real people. That reminded me of Jeremy Corbyn, you know, who praised the British, former British Labour, and he praised the novel because it's about ordinary people. It's about working class people, normal people in everyday life. But it's interesting that, and I was preparing myself for this interview, I did a little bit of research, and apparently in Russia back in 1930s, I guess, there was this Soviet writers, and they harshly criticized this novel for being a bourgeois novel. But when you get to read the novel, it's not. It's really about ordinary people living their lives. And true that, you know, James Joyce said that I put a lot of enigmas and puzzles into this novel to keep professors busy. But at the end of the day, it's a novel written for the people. And you don't really, the first time it's daunting, but as you keep going, it's just like life, discovery of, you know, there are moments of epiphany, discovering symbols and secrets and understanding, you know, what's going on in the novel, the same way that you go about your everyday life. Yeah.
Yeah, there's something really revolutionary about that, I think, for a high modernist novel with all of its innovations in terms of style and like intricate webs of illusion to be centered upon normal people and to celebrate the life of a normal citizen, and to really promote that role of just being a good, productive, person in a society that, you know, that feels like a pretty valuable lesson to us all right now. Be a good citizen, find a way to contribute, and find a way to reconcile differences. Be tolerant. That all feels central to the concepts of this novel, and to the character of Mr. Bloom. That has withstood, certainly that message has withstood the test of time here as we celebrate the centenary. That still feels very important for us all to kind of take on board the role of the citizen, and to kind of understand that is what we all need to kind of do, and keep our eye on that as we, as much as everything else is swirling around us. Yes, but be a good citizen.
And talking about the book itself, there's no spoiler alert really, because the story is simple. We don't have to give any spoiler alert. But just for the uninitiated, let's talk about the book a little. What is this story? One of the characters, Stephen Dedalus, is from Joyce's earlier novel. So tell us what this story is, and then we can talk about the structure of the novel, Ulysses. It's based on Homer's Odyssey, and we also one thing that doesn't really get talked about a lot, but you do talk about it, is references to Shakespeare, especially Hamlet. Yeah, so can you talk about the novel itself? What is it, and talk about the structure of that?
Sure. So the novel is kind of loosely based on Homer's Odyssey, in some very ironic ways. But Joyce described the Odyssey as, in one letter, he described it as the ground plan for the novel. In another letter, he describes it as kind of the scaffolding on the Odyssey, as the scaffolding on which he builds his novel. So in terms of its structure, it's similar to the Odyssey in that the first three episodes, we start with the Telemachus character, Stephen Dedalus, who is a son in search of a father. His own father is not dead. His mother is. But his own father is alive, but is pretty ill-equipped to providing the sort of fatherly guidance that Stephen Dedalus needs. So he is kind of rudderless and struggling and in need of some sort of direction. So that's, we get introduced to the Telemachus Stephen character. And then just like the Odyssey kind of restarts in book five, with the character of Odysseus, we restart in Ulysses in episode four with the character of Mr. Bloom, who is kind of a father in search of a son. His own son died just at 11 days old about 10 years ago. So he is still in lots of ways processing that loss and the implications of that loss. So just like Odysseus is trying to get home and trying to get home to his wife and son, Mr. Bloom is processing not having a son and is trying to come home at the end of this day to his wife in a new way, because what will happen over the course of this day is that his wife, and here's where the kind of parallels to the Odyssey are ironic. Just, Penelope is known for her faithfulness and her patience in waiting for Odysseus to come home and rebuffing the suitors. With her cleverness and guile and steadfast faithfulness to her husband, Mrs. Bloom, Molly Bloom, is going to have an affair this afternoon with her concert tour. She's a prominent soprano in the Dublin kind of music scene. She's going to have an affair this afternoon with Blazes Boylan, who's managing her upcoming concert tour to Belfast and Liverpool. So Mr. Bloom knows about this. He knows that this is going to happen and is, processing what that means for his marriage and what he may have done to to allow for that opening and how he has needs to change as a husband. So it's built on all of that. But essentially, the story is that this guy, Mr. Bloom, gets up, runs a couple morning errands, goes to a funeral, and does a little bit of business. Works as an advertising agent in 1904, which I find that those sorts of things are amazing, that this novel, you know, that Joyce makes his protagonist an ad agent. I mean, that's a nascent, very early in the history of advertising. And of course, that's still so relevant to all of us. We're bombarded with ads all day on our computers, on our phones, on TV, on the radio, everywhere, as driving or walking around town, seeing billboards. So Mr. Bloom is, Joyce understood that that was, that there were legs in this thing, advertising, that was going to be an important part of the 20th and 21st century. His prescience in terms of how a market economy was going to develop over time is pretty amazing. But so he's an ad agent. He does some of that work. He grabs an early supper. He gets into a political argument, basically, with an Irish nationalist that almost gets violent. But Bloom escapes, that's the Cyclops, Odysseus's battle with the Cyclops, or clever escape of the Cyclops. Mr. Bloom eventually ends up at a maternity hospital to check on a friend who's been in the throes of a difficult labor, where he encounters Stephen Dedalus, who is this young man who's, lost in lots of ways and is drunk in this hospital, hanging out with these other medical students. And Mr. Bloom realizes, this guy needs somebody to look after him. I don't think he's okay. And decides to kind of make sure that this kid, makes it home okay, takes care of him. And that is kind of this, kind of coming together of the Telemachus and Odysseus figure. And the end of the novel is basically their, kind of 2 or 3 hours that they spend together that night. So it's one day, and it's pretty normal. There's not a whole, there are big events that happen, but it's a pretty, there are no monsters. Well, I guess you could argue that there are, but there are no whirlpools sucking people down into the ocean. It's a pretty it's a pretty standard, normal day in a city. The novel is kind of the telling of a normal person's day on the scaffolding of an epic, a timeless epic like the Odyssey, which again kind of speaks to how valuable we should see each of our days and how important it is for us to pay attention and recognize the significance of everything that we do and every person that we interact with and every challenge that we face and hopefully overcome, or every challenge that we don't overcome. That all feels like what Joyce was trying to bring our attention to. Mm-hmm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And this is a modernist novel, and there are lots of experimentations with language, lots of portmanteau words. And I guess one of the characteristic chapters is chapter 7, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Aeolus. I think in a part, Jenjus was also trying to play with the idea of form and the idea of novel in a way. So can you comment on the modernist elements of the novel and Joyce's experimentation with language?
Absolutely. Yeah. From the beginning, so the Aeolus episode is one of those first episodes that my students, you know, kind of scratch their head and say, why are there newspaper headlines in a novel? Which is a great question. And why is there a 150-page surrealist play in a novel? And why is there a catechism in a novel? Like all of those different forms being incorporated into the novel was revolutionary and was certainly a modernist idea of making, exploding a form and expanding an idea of what a thing could be. And T.S. Eliot from the very beginning understood that, what Joyce was up to with that, and said, you know, if this is not a novel, it's because it's a form that will no longer serve, you know, that Joyce has kind of expanded that. And I'm not sure that that's exactly right, because I'm not sure that other novelists have maybe tried, but not pushed beyond the boundaries that Joyce set for the novel as a form. But it's certainly Aeolus with those newspaper headlines, kind of framing the different sections of the prose narrative. It is revolutionary, and it does beg all sorts of questions and prompt all sorts of questions about, well, why can't newspaper headlines be in a novel? Why, in what ways do we want to set those boundaries? And then what is a newspaper? And why is that reading experience different? Or, you know, they're all, you know, if telling a story and if bringing, using allusion and providing references, like where do we draw those lines? And Joyce was kind of working within kind of the nooks and crannies of what we understood about a novel in a way that was, I think, generative in a lot of ways. You know, I think a lot of it opened doors to other writers and other creatives, you know, where maybe you see some of that in TV or in cinema, you know, that, you know, film can maybe play with genre in a way that novels can but maybe haven't to the same degree since Joyce. But yeah, it was certainly if Pound called for modernists to make it new, certainly Joyce's Ulysses made the idea of the novel anew for all kinds of writers and artists and readers.
And I was also quite surprised. I knew that the book had been banned, but I was quite surprised to understand that United States was the first country that sort of English-speaking country that lifted the ban. And then in Ireland, it wasn't formally banned, but I guess it was until 1960s that the novel was published. So tell us a little about the history of the book itself. Why was it banned? No, there are obscenities in the book, but it's quite surprising that the book was banned in 1920s. And also in Ireland, how come it took 40 years, you know, for the novel to be publicly released in Ireland?
Yeah. So there's I'll start with the initial banning. So in 1920, in the late 19 teens, Ulysses was being published serially, so kind of episode by episode, you know, chapter by chapter, in an avant-garde literary magazine called The Little Review, that was run by two women, Margaret Anderson and Jane Heap. And they So they were publishing this, you know, bit by bit. Once they got to the Nausicaa episode, which has a stylized, but still inappropriate, depiction of inappropriate behavior by Mr. Bloom on the beach. He pleasures himself while looking at a young girl and kind of having a little bit of a silent connection with her, kind of at twilight. Obviously that drew attention to this novel, and the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice flagged it, pulled it in, said, you can't publish obscenity and you can't send it through the post. You can't send it through the post office. So it ended up being put up on trial. And in February of 1920, Ulysses was deemed obscene and nobody else could touch it from that point on. Or nobody was willing to touch it from that point on in the English speaking world, which is why the novel was eventually published in France by Sylvia Beach at Shakespeare and Company bookstore, because a French printer was not, falling victim or making themselves vulnerable to American or English law in the same way that an English printer or a printer in New York would have, been held liable for printing obscenity. So the book is banned, but the first edition of 1,000 copies gets sold from Shakespeare and Company. There's another edition from the Egoist Press that does come out. Is printed in and gets kind of there. Are, I think 2,000 copies in that edition, but Shakespeare and Company I think did 11 printings, different editions, that came out in the 20s, and then eventually Random House decides that they're going to try to challenge this ban on the book. And they smuggle in, I think cleverly, they smuggle in a copy of Ulysses and had taped inside of it all of these critical opinions from literary critics, from scholars that were celebrating what an achievement this novel was and placing it in in the context of literary understanding and exploration and creativity and innovation. So the book gets seized at the border or in the port of New York, but it had all that stuff in it. So all of those essays and articles were taken in as evidence. So the judge had to consider all of that as he was studying the novel to issue his ruling. And the judge was a man named John Woolsey. And then in December of 1933, he issues his ruling that essentially you have to view this novel as a whole, and to take the Nausicaa episode on its own or that moment of the Nausicaa episode on its own would be deemed obscene. But when you understand a character and Joyce's intention of trying to represent a fully formed human being, as he has done with like this extreme realism, if that human being happens to be, have sexualized thoughts and some sexual kind of proclivities, then that's what Joyce was trying to represent, was this character, having weaknesses, not trying to titillate or trying to arouse, or it's not pornographic in nature. So he understood that and kind of saw those moments of sexual content as tiles in a larger mosaic of the human experience, and released the novel from its ban. And so it became, it was then able to be published in the United States and England. And as you say, in Ireland, it wasn't ever formally banned, but people were not interested in reading it for a long, long time. There's a great book that just came out this year, called Consuming Joyce by John McCourt. I don't know if you've encountered that one yet, but it tells the story of the reception of Ulysses in Ireland and talks about how people regarded, in the 20s and 30s, up through really the 60s, And I'm sure that there are still people like this today, you know, in an Irish, predominantly Irish Catholic country, the blasphemous nature of this novel, they saw Joyce as something of an antichrist and, you know, wanted nothing to do with him. So nobody was interested in reading the filth that Joyce had written. They weren't going to go there. So it wasn't really until the 80s, as McCourt kind of points out, that Ireland started to embrace Joyce as a representative voice in their literary history. But it's a complicated relationship between Joyce and Ireland. Joyce was in exile. He lived almost, you know, probably 2/3 of his life away from Ireland. And, the book was banned and then it wasn't, but still people for, you know, the next 30, 40 years weren't interested in reading it in Ireland.
It's a fascinating story how the novel was the story of the reception of the novel in Ireland. And nowadays, whenever you speak of Dublin, James Joyce is there. He's one of the iconic figures who, in a way, it's kind of ironic. I tend to think of it this way, that it's James Joyce who has given this history and legacy to Ireland and Dublin. The moment you hear the word Dublin or Ireland, James Joyce. And we have the Bloomsday Festival, which this year you told me earlier that you attended. So I guess that's a perfect segue into my next question, which is the significance of setting of the novel, which is Dublin, and maps and cartography. I read some time ago, I was reading about the theory of space and fictions. I read that lots of visitors who go to London, those who love Sherlock Holmes, they go and try to find 221B Baker Street, which doesn't really exist, but people go to find it. And I also read that even similar, some visitors who go to Dublin, they try to trace back the places that the places that Harold Bloom walked on that day, which is June 16th. So can you imagine a novel being written in a different city or a different country? What is the significance of setting Dublin and also maps? Because in your website and also in your books, you have maps of Dublin. So what is the significance of setting and place? And then maybe after that, you can also talk about Bloomsday Festival, which you recently attended.
Yeah, sure. So Joyce said that in the particular is found the universal. And I think that the setting of the novel in Dublin, I mean, it is so particular and such exacting detail of this street, what shops are on this street. And he was using references, the Tom's Directory from 1904, to try to be as accurate as possible in representing the city. I mean, he also kind of preposterously suggested that if Dublin were to be destroyed by some catastrophe, that it could be rebuilt brick by brick from his novel. And that's an overstatement, obviously. But he was a salesman and he knew that there was some truth to that he had represented this city of Dublin really, really accurately and very carefully in terms of, not just space and not just like what is on this street, but how long it would take a character to walk from this place to this place and how many different thoughts they might have, you know, on that, in that amount of time. So there's like a real pacing, both in terms of thought and in terms of walking that you can study, and that there have been pretty fascinating studies of like words per minute or words per second that a character might think in their inner monologue and what feels natural and so forth. So I think that idea of like in the particular is the universal, that you can imagine this novel being set in San Francisco or in Melbourne, Australia, or in Paris, if you just were to kind of transform it into the very particular parts of that city. You know, the particularity of Dublin, it creates this, I guess, kind of like an understanding or an impression of we are in a real place. We are in a city. And I think that was also part of what made this work so well, and what makes the novel continue to work so well 100 years on, is that Dublin had a modern mass transit system, had all kinds of, kind of modern, mass media, multiple news cycles in a day, morning and evening newspapers for an increasingly literate populace. It was really on the cusp of the world that feels so familiar to us. We've already talked about advertising agents, but that all, each of those different elements makes this city experience feel very relevant today, so I think that he was so painstaking in representing that city in a way that it made, certainly it immortalizes Dublin and makes Dublin itself, a tourist attraction for people who do want to go retrace the steps of Mr. Bloom. But it also kind of creates a model that you can, appreciate that's what walking through the streets of Baltimore, you could do the same sort of thing, thinking about, okay, I'm walking by Mick O'Shea's pub and now here is a salad shop. And, you can understand how it's a universal experience of walking through a city street in the way that Mr. Bloom does in Ulysses.
And let us talk about the audio version of the book. There are a lot of audiobooks, but one of them that I guess is the most famous one is a radio production, RTE Radio, which was produced in 1982 or 3, if I'm not mistaken. I myself, whenever I read one chapter, I give myself a bit of rest. And in the meantime, before starting the second one, I listen to the audio, to the audio version, which is a dramatized production. There are different characters speaking for the other character, which has helped me a lot because sometimes when I read the novel, I kind of lose track of who's speaking, but the radio production helps me. So let me phrase this question this way as a piece of advice to a first-time reader. One of the most important pieces of advice that he gave was to not to stop reading a novel. It's daunting. Just keep reading. I was talking to a friend of mine who read the novel, and he told me that he started with the audio version. He just listened to this before reading the novel. So, what is your advice there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a lot of people who use that RTE recording and appreciate. And I think its benefit, as you kind of point out, is it has a cast of different readers who are dramatizing and bringing those different voices to life and in a way that helps you to understand, okay, that's the narrator's voice. That echo effect signals that now we're in inner monologue, there are technical devices that they used in putting that audio recording together and that performance. It's a performance of the novel in a way that an audiobook obviously is too, but not in a cast like that. That there's some real benefit to that kind of consistency of interpretive performance that they give. But I also find, different audiobooks are great. Shakespeare and Company Bookstore this year did a series. They had over 100 readers read different sections of Ulysses. And so you get a lot of different voices, and that was really fun. And some of those readings, I'm thinking of like Stephen Fry's reading of Oxen of the Sun and Tara Mulholland's reading of Oxen of the Sun were really revealing to me that Oxen is really funny, and it, as difficult as it is, because it parodies 32 prose styles and is, very dense and kind of, the way that it doesn't ever like settle on telling the story in a consistent style, it revealed to me that those performances revealed to me how funny it was and that Joyce is in on that joke. And that he was having fun with it too. So certainly the RTE, there are a lot of first time readers who find some grounding in that performance, and I highly recommend it. Yeah.
And when you were reading the novel and researching it, which chapter was the most challenging and at the same time stimulating one to you?
Well, when I the most challenging one was probably Oxen, as I just kind of referenced, because it is it shifts so quickly that it's dizzying and you never really kind of get your feet under you, and you're like trying to, you understand what he's doing with this progression of styles as it's seeking to replicate embryonic development. And there's just so many different layers of discourse that, that you have to kind of wade through. So that one kind of, although I'm finding that that episode for the past year or two has been maybe my favorite, which is a weird thing to admit. It's not everyone's favorite. It's kind of, you know, it's emerged as that. It's an acquired taste, I guess. So Oxen is that way. I think to teach, Nausicaa is the most difficult episode because my students are so, you know, high school kids, 18-year-olds, so quick to condemn and see things in you know, black and white. Like what Mr. Bloom does on the beach is wrong and reprehensible. And like, yes, it is. Of course, let's also appreciate what is transpiring between him and Gertie McDowell. It's difficult for me as a teacher of high school students to try to get them to see some gray area in something that really is morally, kind of atrocious, what he does there. But, that's a tricky episode to teach. That always is a class period where I really need to be on my toes. And that episode, reverberates, you know, through the rest of their reading. They struggle to get over that, in a way that adults, I've taught an adult class, they kind of shrug like, okay, yeah, it's kind of gross, but he's kind of a quirky guy. He's lonesome. You know, the adults in my class, I was prepared for it to be more like with my high school students, and they were like, "Yeah, I get it." So it kind of caught. I was pleasantly surprised that was an easier class period with the adults than I thought it might be. Yeah.
Earlier, I mentioned that Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of Labour Party, former leader of Labour Party, praised the book, you know, lauded the book, and said that everybody should read this book. And we know that James Joyce was also involved in his writings. He addressed the political issues of the time. So what is the political significance, or what are some political issues that he deals with in this novel?
So, I mean, on its face, the novel's very political. You know, you have to have an appreciation for Ireland as a colony of Great Britain at the time that Joyce is writing, and certainly in the 1904 Dublin that he's depicting, and the, you know, debates over Irish nationalism and how, like whether violence is the right answer. There's a lot of political discourse over the course of that novel. The whole novel is just kind of drenched with that. But I find, you know, most notably and maybe most timely at its core, I feel like Ulysses espouses inclusiveness. That feels like a principal political issue of our time, certainly here in the United States. These are, you know, parts of what we're wrestling with a lot and across the world, because Mr. Bloom is a Jewish man in Dublin at the turn of the century. You know, he endures and confronts an atmosphere of anti-Semitism throughout the course of the single day we spend with him. Through Joyce's innovative technique of inner monologue, we have access to Mr. Bloom's thoughts and feelings in those moments where he's suffering, slights and prejudice. And the reader's, you know, intimate understanding of this character instills, I think, a call to empathy. Essentially, like, having experienced the world through the eyes of Mr. Bloom and having gained an appreciation for the depth of humanity that we all share, how can we not be careful of the real people we encounter in our daily lives? That feels like something that this novel is prompting us to do. And the writing style of the novel further emphasizes that spirit of inclusivity in the way that Joyce absorbs so many different types of writing into Ulysses. You know, given that we have a chapter written in the style of a syrupy, sweet Victorian romance novel, sitting alongside a chapter written in the form of a surrealist play, You know, we have chapters that contain literally dozens of different literary styles, from legal contracts to sports journalism, from medieval legend to Dickensian narrative, that all demonstrate, I think, a democratic ideal that differences can coexist together and indeed can inform and strengthen the other. That feels like part of the political message of this novel to me, is our differences make us more interesting. And that's kind of put together through the way that the novel tells this story.
Patrick, it's been a fascinating conversation. But before we end the conversation, I'd like to ask you to read your favorite section of the novel. Understand how difficult it must be for you to choose. But yeah, maybe that's the best way to end this podcast.
Sure. And like favorite section, whenever I'm asked to do something like this, I usually just open the book at random and see where it falls. And it, when I did this last night in preparation, since you'd kind of tipped me off that you might ask me to do this, it opened right at the end of the Cyclops episode, which is, you know, kind of a cool moment, climactic sort of moment. So this is the Nameless One is our narrator. And this is the very end, as the citizen, who is kind of our Cyclops correspondence character, an Irish nationalist who's gotten into kind of an altercation with Mr. Bloom over the nature of nationalism. So there's been a whole kerfuffle over basically the idea that these guys in a pub think that Mr. Bloom has just made a bunch of money betting on a dark horse in the Gold Cup horse race, which he hasn't, but they think that he's made a bunch of money and he's not standing around. But anyway, he's on his way out. The Nameless One says, "You never saw the like of it in all your born puff. Gob, if he got that lottery ticket on the side of his pole, he'd remember the Gold Cup. He would so. But the Gob, the citizen, would have been lagged for assault and battery, and Joe for aiding and abetting. The Jarvie saved his life by furious driving as sure as God made Moses. What? Oh, Jesus, he did. And he let a volley of oaths after him. 'Did I kill him?' says he. 'Or what?' And he shouting to the bloody dog, 'After him, Gary! After him, boy!' And the last we saw was the bloody car rounding the corner and the old sheep's face on it gesticulating and the bloody mongrel after it with his lugs back for all he was bloody well worth to tear him limb from limb. 100-5. Jesus, he took the value out of him, I promise you. When lo," and then it kind of shifts into this strange, like, biblical voice. "When lo, there came about them all a great brightness, and they beheld the chariot wherein he stood ascend to heaven. And they beheld him," and him is Mr. Bloom here, "in the chariot, clothed upon in the glory of the brightness, having raiment as of the sun, fair as the moon, and terrible, that for all they durst not look upon him. And there came a voice out of heaven, calling, 'Elijah, Elijah,' and he answering with a main cry, 'Abba, Adonai.' And they beheld him, even him, born Ben Bloom Elijah, amid clouds of angels ascend to the glory of the brightness at an angle of 45 degrees over Donahue's and Little Green Street, like a shot off a shovel." And that ends the Cyclops and ends our conversation. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you very much for this conversation. And I do encourage our listeners, those who have always loved James Boyce but were afraid to pick up the book, to pick up the book Ulysses, and also go to your website or get the book, The Guide to James Joyce's Ulysses, published by John Hopkins University. Thank you very much, Patrick.
Thank you so much. It's been a fun conversation.